Welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast. I know who I am. Do you know who I am? I mean, I know, but do you know that I know that you know? John St. Augustine with you one more time. We go up the down staircase in the outdoor, look for the sense in the senseless, and if at all possible, which sometimes is really difficult, we're looking for the obvious truths buried in the absurdity of life. Let's get to it. Welcome, welcome, welcome. I am delighted to have you with me one more time as we try to figure some things out. You know, this, let me just start with full disclosure, which is like my middle name these days. I do a show that airs daily in New York and Washington, D.C., and I have a co-host in Beijing, China, named Hu Yang, who is on with me during the week. And on the weekends, it's a delightful journalist named Bebe, and we really are doing whatever we can to solidify and keep intact the cultural connections between the United States and China, because it's a storied history with a lot of ups and downs, just like any other relationship. So when I was approached to do this, I maintained that I would do it under a few conditions. And one of those conditions was that I would have the opportunity to have full disclosure, that there would be nobody over my shoulder, there'd be nobody editing my work, there'd be nobody telling me what I can or can't say, and they agreed to that. So the full disclosure thing over the last couple of months has become paramount to me. And in the times we're living in, I'm all about the full disclosure. I don't like things that aren't disclosed. It doesn't help anybody. It's this, you know, kind of a shell game stuff going on in the back room. And I'm not about that. Put it up front. Here's the deal. Like it or leave it. Here's the deal, right? So this podcast, in full disclosure up front, I'm not sure where it's going to go. There are some things that are just really bothering me, and my mantra is usually, when in doubt, write it out. But I'm working on so many different writing projects, that's the last thing I want to do. So I've been looking at the microphone that's sitting off to the side when it's not in use with a bunch of really other expensive equipment. And I said, listen, I just need to get this off my brain pan and see what comes of it. And the first thing that's bothering me more than anything else is the loss of my friends over the last few months. And look, I've been around long enough to know that this is the way it ends for all of us, but it's never expected, meaning if you're talking to someone and 3 or 4 weeks later they're not here, you kind of go, wait, what? And that's happened before. It will happen again. But it never leaves me that jarring feeling that I missed something, or that I should have done something different, or I should have made one more call. Or, you know, there's a lot of people that I keep saving their voicemails just so I can hear what they sound like in case they don't show up the next day. So it started back when Joe Laurinaitis passed away a couple of months ago at the age of 60. He, of course, was Road Warrior Animal with the Legion of Doom, the Road Warriors, along with Mike Hawk Hegstrand. And Mike passed away back in 03. He was just 46 years old. And his was a sudden death, and Joe's was a sudden death. And, you know, even though I can get esoteric about this stuff and make it work for me in my mind, saying, look, I get it rationally. You know, we're all going to die. Bottom line, that's it. We may not get along while we're alive, but I tell you one thing we have in common is we're all going to die. What isn't common is that most people that I've run into live like some of these people have lived at such a high level. And I'm not even talking about sports or entertainment or anything like that. I'm talking about they found something within themselves that was bigger than themselves, and they brought that to the world. And I think then we all go watch people like that. And no more apparent is that than in sports, professional sports. And I spent enough time with the roadies to tell you that while the outcome of the wrestling matches was, for the most part, assured, they didn't always play by the rules, number one. And number two, the schedule these guys kept, sometimes upwards of 300 days a year, on the road, all over the world, literally, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, you name it, they've been everywhere, as are a lot of pro wrestlers. It might not be a sport as we deem it, baseball, basketball, football, hockey, whatever a sport would be. It's definitely an athletic endurance event. To see them travel as they did, to take the pounding night after night, even though they're trained, to take the pounding night after night, man, that's tough stuff. So when Joe passed away, I was in Michigan visiting my son, and it just was a bone cruncher. And it wasn't long before that I lost a friend of mine named Phil Larson. And Phil and I went to high school together. We played football together. We played football against each other later. We played softball against each other later. We drank beer together. I didn't see him for almost 35 years at one point. We reconnected about 7 years ago, and we became really close again. We went to grammar school together. I mean, this is lifelong stuff. And he was doing really well. He had lost a lot of weight, even though he had some existing health issues that probably were his undoing in the end. He had really resurrected himself from the guy that I had reconnected with. He had lost all the weight, as I said, and really on an upward trajectory, just doing great. And so his passing was jarring to me, like Joe's was jarring to me. And many of the people that I've had in my life who were here in an instant and then gone, those are the jarring ones. Not someone who's been lingering, which is a whole nother level of pain, but you see some relief in that for them, that that their life, while cut short, at least wasn't one of suffering more than it needed to be. And, you know, I'm using my father as an example. My dad had a lot of health problems, mostly towards the end of his life. My mom had passed away in 1997. And by the last days of my dad's life, he was really up against it. I wrote about that in my second book called Every Moment Matters, about being with him when he passed away. And the thing that came as a gift for me, which was hard to see immediately, but within hours it was very apparent, was that as much difficulty as my father was in towards the end of his life, you know, there's somebody once said, and I don't know if this is, if I get all this, but somebody once said that you die the way you live. And I'm not sure I grasp all that, but I will tell you that underneath all of my father's physical difficulties, he was a really good guy, meaning I don't think he deserved to suffer, because he didn't impart suffering on anybody that I know of, except as a bill collector at the bank, but that was money they owed in an undue way. So it wasn't like he was a, you know, some kind of an asshole and running around. Then he, all of a sudden, you know, the angels lifted him up. He was a good guy his whole life. He did the best he could with what he had. While he and I did not always see eye to eye, so what? That's how it works. You're supposed not to see that way all the time. And so, but when he passed away, my sister and I were with him in the room. It was a truly incredible adventure the night before. And again, the book is called Every Moment Matters. There's a chapter in there called Captain Dracula. At this time of the year, around Halloween, my dad would transform himself from the banker into Dracula. Bottom line, for like 25 years he did this. And it was his alter ego in many ways. You know, he was this very helpful banker during the day and supported a lot of things and helped a lot of people. And then for about 2 months during the year, he'd just scare the living shit out of him in the basement of our house, which had become this big haunted mansion. Kids and adults would literally stand outside for hours to pay 25 or 50 cents a head to go in and get the snot scared out of him. And it was just a really interesting thing. Halloween was bigger than Christmas at my house. And so my dad was all about that. And so the night before he passed, I was in the room next to him. My sister had gone home. I was by myself. His room was connected to this little offside room. And I'm sitting there watching television, and this thunderstorm's come up. And it's like, you know, it's in May, it's springtime, and so thunderstorms are not unusual. And I turn on the TV, and there is like The Horror of Dracula or something with Christopher Lee, who, while my dad admired Bela Lugosi greatly, he thought Christopher Lee was the shits, man. The 6'3", big teeth, the whole deal. And that movie came on as my dad lay in the next room dying. And if there was one thing that was bigger than Halloween or Dracula for my dad, it was Star Trek. And right after that movie, amazingly, it rolled into a Star Trek movie, which I am not a Trekkie. Sorry, I can do the Live Long and Prosper. That's about it. But this particular movie was the one where like they come back to Earth and they're helping to save whales and stuff. And I must have nodded off when Dracula was ending and then this show came on. And here I was with the two essences, really, of my father, who was loved this Dracula stuff and horror stuff and just made his year. And then over here, he was this Trekkie guy. He was this guy that loved to fantasy to get away. And if he could have got on a ship and gone off to the moon, I think he would have. But my point in this is that when he passed away, those were the elements that were in my head of this man who had, you know, was there when I was born. And I was there with my sister, as I mentioned, when he was passing to the next realm. And the most amazing transformation took place when I saw him finally take his last breath. All measure of pain was gone. All measure of difficulty was gone. All measure of angst and anxiety was gone. All manner of stress and struggle was gone. And here was this guy. He looked, it always comes back to me. His skin to me looked to be alabaster. It was clean and clear and smooth, and it was really something. And I've been on the scene of accidents where I didn't see that. People who were killed in auto accidents. I've had to fish a couple of people out of the lake that shouldn't have been in there and drowned, and they didn't look like that. But my dad went through that process, and as difficult as it was for my sister and I and everybody that loved them, there was a great measure of peace in that. Wasn't there when Phil passed, and I wasn't there when Joe passed. And this last Thursday, I was on the air doing some work. As I mentioned, I do this show called The Bridge, and I got a message through Facebook from a guy who said Matt Blair had passed away. And that was it really caught me off guard. Now, Matt Blair was an incredible human being. On one hand, you would know him if you're a football fan. Matt was a linebacker drafted in the second round out of Iowa State in 1974, played all of his 12 NFL seasons with the Vikings in Minnesota, racked up 1,452 tackles per Minnesota, which is second in team history. And from 1977 to 82, he was in six consecutive Pro Bowls with a 1980 All-Pro selection. Possessing a nose for the football, Blair totaled 16 career interceptions and 20 fumble recoveries. In his 12-season tenure with the Vikings, they went to the postseason seven times, and Matt got to play in two Super Bowls. I knew him post-career. A lot of these guys were just after they got out of football. Tony Galbraith, who was Matt's teammate in the last couple, 3 years of his time at the Vikings. Same thing. I met him right after he retired. I'll get to Tony in just a minute. But he was introduced to me by Stedman Graham, who ran at the time the Athletes Against Drugs organization. He may still do that. I'm not sure. And I met Matt playing in a golf tournament. And then I got invited to play in Matt's golf tournaments. I wasn't really a celebrity at the time yet. I don't even know if I really am now, but what the hell. But I played at six or seven of those, and then Tony Galbraith would fly up from St. Louis, meet me in Chicago, and he and I, and sometimes his buddy Winford Brown, we'd drive from Chicago to Minneapolis for these events. And those road trips, let me tell you something. There's so many lessons in this for me. So first off, I had a 1970 Chevy Impala land boat, four-door. It was great. Huge car. So there was no problem taking it and going up north. It was a wonderful car. And we were, you know, it's 6-7 hours, something like that, from Chicago to Minneapolis. And we had the time. And so we did that. And there was one time in particular, I remember driving up north and something went south on the car. I don't know if like a water hose or something. And we had to pull into this little town. Now, Tony Galbraith and Winford Brown are African-American. I'm not. And so we're quite a sight. When you pull into mostly an all-white town in the middle of Wisconsin, and we come rolling in this 1970 Impala, the three of us, all of us, well over 200-plus pounds, if not a lot more, and it's the middle of the day, and we pull into this auto, like a car parts place, come walking in the door, and it was one of those scenes like in a movie where everybody stops and just looks at you. My first thought was, why is there so many people in an auto parts store at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon in the middle of Wisconsin? But it was like a gathering place, a watering hole for people. And they all kind of just looked. And I got to tell you know, it was a little bit unnerving to me because you could feel the tension just because they were black. And so I took the lead and I said, listen, I got this Impala, this and that. And the guy's like, what do you need? And I think it was a water hose. And we start talking and somebody spotted Tony Galbraith's Super Bowl ring. Tony played with the Super Bowl 21 New York Giants right after the Bears won it in 85, 86, it would have been 87. And he was wearing his ring because we were headed north. That ring changed everything. All of a sudden, they wanted to know who he was and what was going on. Once he said his name, everybody in the auto parts store knew who Tony Galbraith was. When he retired, he was, I believe, stretching here a little bit, but I believe he was the all-time leading combined yards, rushing, passing, returning kicks, stuff like that, in the NFL back in the day. I'm sure that's been broken, but back then he was the man. He was in the backfield with Chuck Muncy at one point in New Orleans. So they were thunder and lightning. And then, of course, he played, like I said, with the Saints the Vikings, and there was another team in there somewhere. I can't remember who else he played with, but there were two or three teams that Tony made 12-year career as well. So that, first of all, was like this, wow, look what a Super Bowl ring changes. Or once you're a someone of name and note, that seems to change a little bit. That was interesting. We went to Matt's event, and it was fantastic. You know, we were hanging out with the heavy hitters and people from Hollywood. It was just a lot of fun. And I got to tell you, the one thing, and I'm doing with this with all respect I can muster, because Leon Spinks, who is a former heavyweight champion, was there with his wife at the time, Betty. We flew up on at one point, he flew up, I would say, for the event. He's a great boxer at the time, but he is not a golfer. And that was quickly apparent. So he had no golfing equipment whatsoever. He had no clubs, he had no shoes, no nothing. So Matt found him a pair of shoes and all this kind of stuff. And part of the deal was that the course, all the homes that run the golf course, we would stop there. There had to be 75 celebrities playing. So we would like stop and play, and people were out in their yards and we would talk and stuff like that. And at one point, we were at somebody's home and we come walking in, and you know, you could tell that they were thrilled to have people, but they just didn't know what the hell to do with us. And Leon Spinks had to go to the washroom. So the woman asked if he would take his golf shoes off to go in the house. Oh, absolutely. And I don't know where he got these socks at. But Leon Spinks was wearing black nylon, like dress socks to play golf in. And there were no like holes in the tops where his toes were sticking out. I'd never seen toes like that. His toes were like the Velociraptor in Jurassic Park. Now, again, I'm just saying what it was. And we all couldn't believe it. And so he walked across the floor, and it literally was like, here's the heavyweight champion of the world at one time walking across this woman's floor with these nylon socks and his toes sticking out the front with Velociraptor feet. It was really stunning. But he's a great guy, and we had a lot of fun with him, and it was a wonderful thing. And these events were so important. Matt Blair's celebrity golf tournaments raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for many different charities and causes in the greater Minneapolis area. And so we were always so thrilled to be invited to go. And I think we drove up two or three times. Then they'd fly us up, and that was a lot of fun. And it was a great time. And so when you're in that orbit for those years and you're with these people and you see how they have used their celebrity to help change lives, it's kind of rubs off on you. It's like, you know, if I ever get to a point where I'm able to do things with what I've been given, then that's what you do. You don't just keep it to yourself. And Matt was an amazing photographer, as I mentioned, and he would take these pictures all year round, then frame them, and then those would be signed and part of the silent auction, and they'd go for, you know, $5,000, $10,000, $12,000. Amazing guy. But there's one story that I remember more than all the rest, really. He called me once. This is, again, 20 years ago, 15, probably 20 years ago. I hadn't even moved to Michigan yet, so this would have been, oh boy, 25 years ago. He calls up and he says, hey, I'm coming to Chicago. Can we hang out? I'm in for the weekend. I'm like, well, hanging out to him is different than hanging out to me. Hanging out with Matt for the weekend meant we're playing as much golf as humanly possible. Now, that's not a bad thing, except I'm not that good. And he was very good. So he says, if we can hang, I said, and I had a wedding on a Saturday. And I said, listen, I got this wedding. I can't. He goes, I'll tell you what, pick me up at O'Hare. Drop me off the nearest course and just come back when you're done. I'm like, what? He goes, I'll be fine. Pick him up at O'Hare. The nearest course was a public course called Billy Caldwell. It's a forest preserve course here in Chicago or outside of Chicago. And so I said, listen, you sure you want to do this? He said, yeah. So when I left him, he was at the little putting practice area. He had his bag of clubs and his whole thing. Matt Blair was 6'5", 245 pounds. Even after his playing days, you knew he was an athlete. He's a huge guy, but just a gentle giant, really. So he waves, and off I go. I don't think I came back for 6-8 hours, somewhere in there. I mean, I kind of forgot him out at one point. Didn't have any cell phones back then. So I excuse myself from the wedding, and I drive all the way back. It's pitch dark. They close at 9, so I probably got there like at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, whatever it was. It's getting darker and darker. And I pull up and he's not, I'm like, where am I going to find this guy? And I pull into the main parking area and there's Matt surrounded by, I don't know, 30 people, 40 people telling stories about his years with the Vikings and how difficult it was to tackle Walter Payton. And I saw him once again as this guy who felt so blessed to play football and was going to use it for the betterment of something else. Nobody plays forever. And long after you're gone, you know, do something with it is really kind of how it went for me. And then we kind of went back and forth over the years and, you know, people go on and things change. And I reconnected with him in early 2019. I had heard that he was having some difficulties. There were some dementia things going on. There may have been a couple articles I saw online. So I actually just reached out got in touch with him. And, you know, he sounded tired and he sounded slow and he was having difficulty. But then he would light up when I said, hey, Matt, remember the time when Leon Spinks took his shoes off in that lady's house? We laughed. And I knew he was in some serious difficulty there. So, but then you forget. At least, you know, you go on and life goes on and other things happen. And next thing you know, and here's this message that Matt Blair passed away at the age of 70. And the dementia at the end was very, very obviously difficult and is believed to be complications from CTE, the neurodegenerative disease linked to football and considered to be the signature menace, really, in the NFL's concussion claims in the recent years. And this is tough for me. It's on one hand, once again, he's not suffering. Thank God. On the other hand, so much, at 70, he's young. I'm pushing 62, so that's like right down the street for me. Make a left, there it is. And so once I hear this and I start thinking of the other names that go along with CTE and the things that come out of that, this is something that, you know, the NFL denied for years and they had to eventually fess up. And there's a whole, you can watch movies on it, video. I'm not going to get in all that here, except for the fact that according to a 2017 study on brains of deceased football players, 99% of tested brains of NFL players, 88% of CFL, Canadian football players, 64% of semi-pro players, that would be me, 91% of college football players, that would be me, and 21% of high school football players, that would be me, had various stages of CTE. One more time, because it bears repeating. According to a 2017 study just 3 years ago on brains of deceased gridiron players, football players, 99% of tested brains of NFL players, 88% of CFL, 64% of semi-pro, 91% of college, and 21% of high school football players had various stages of CTEs. That's upon examination of their deceased brains. But the ones that make the headlines are the ones we know the most. Those are the ones that, you know, we couldn't believe that a Junior Seau would take his own life, or a Dave Duerson would take their own lives because of that. And the list of former players that are confirmed is, I mean, it's endless. Dwight Clark, Art DiCarlo, Dave Duerson, as I mentioned, Frank Gifford, Cookie Gilchrist, and Chris Henry, and Aaron Hernandez, who talk about a life that just went in a left turn. I don't even how to explain that. Wally Hilgenberg was a linebacker. Tom Keating and Terry Long. Rob Lytle, an incredible running back. John Mackey, the amazing tight end. Ollie Mattson, a running back. Earl Morrill, the quarterback. Larry Morris, Paul Oliver. Tommy Nobis, one of the best linebackers to ever play the game. Mike Pyle played center for the Bears. Junior Seau, as I mentioned. Bubba Smith. Bubba Smith was, outside of Deacon Jones, was the premier defensive end in football for a decade or more. Kenny Stabler, the Snake. Mosi Tatupu, who played in the NFL. Kevin Turner, Andre Waters, Mike Webster. So much of this started with Mike Webster's death. He was the Iron Man center for the Pittsburgh Steelers and just was ended up living out of his car at the end of his life. So those are the ones that are the name players that were confirmed with that. And then there's a whole list of living former players diagnosed with CTE or ALS, or at least reporting symptoms consistent with CTE or ALS. And Mike Adamley is at the top of the list. Mike's 71 years young now, And he, along with his wife, Kim, have really mounted an offensive to bring awareness to this challenge. He's incredibly good shape, but she works with him constantly to help him with things to maintain that. And not everybody has that sort of support behind them. Lance Briggs, who played linebacker for the Bears, and Joe DeLamalur, who was an amazing offensive lineman, Tony Dorsett, Brett Favre, Dwight Harrison, Larry Johnson, Tim Green, Bernie Kosar, Leonard Marshall, and Jim McMahon, who played quarterback for the Bears, this punky QB, and Tim Shaw, Steve Smith, and Daryl Talley, and Frank Wycheck. All these are living players that are having these difficulties. Then there is 4,500 players who reached a settlement in 2013 with the NFL, and that list is far too long to even think about going into here. But here's the deal for me. Here's where it's the pros and the cons with everything we do in life. Everything has a cost to it. Everything has a price to be paid at some point. And on one hand, football taught me so much about life that I don't know what my life would be had I not played midget, high school, college, and semi-pro football. The lessons are just too numerous to mention, but I'll try to get a few in. Just the discipline itself of showing up time and time and time again and going over and over and executing and executing and executing, looking for some sort of perfection, is not what most normal people are used to doing. And then practicing for endless hours in adverse conditions or playing games in adverse conditions. You know, pushing yourself to the limit because you're in a part of a team. You know, I've got to get paid to play football. These guys all got paid. That's neither here nor there to me. They played because they were good at it, and there is a way for them to apply their talent in the world. There's an outlet for that. Then there's all these semi-pro college, high school guys like me who played for the love of the game because we knew what it gave us, and we were good at it. I'm here to tell you, at least for a while. And so there's that part of it. There's so many lessons the game gave me. Those are the pros and the people I've met, the people I'm still in touch with, the camaraderie that comes with putting on a helmet and it, when a play's over, helping your guy up and getting him going again. And that doesn't end when the game's over. You do that the rest of your life. You do that the rest of your life. And then the cons, of course, is none of my fingers are straight. I don't know how I can type. When I turn my head, it sounds like there's marbles in there that are all busted up sometimes. My knees, forget it. You know, I had two or three surgeries on my right knee. Left knee was just banged up, but no surgeries. They took cartilage out of my right knee. And to this day, I can tell you 12 hours before it's going to rain. I don't care who doesn't believe me because I'm telling you, it's coming. And it does. There's a pressure thing there. And, you know, my neck and my back. But these are things that are the price that was to be paid for engaging in this kind of activity. So while I may moan and groan a little bit, I'm okay with that. What I'm not okay with, what gives me pause, is when I feel like there are things going on for me mentally that I can't discern whether that's just normal or not. I have a friend of mine who is a fantastic football player, Bob Kowalski, who's co-captain in high school around 1980 and went on to play college ball at Valparaiso, and then years later he came to play semi-pro with the same team that I was on, and this guy was a freight train. We got along really, really well. And Bob fell into the cracks for a long time after that, and I saw him 6 years ago, 7 years ago, when he was a shell of his former self, and he had a lot of physical problems, and his mom had passed away, and a lot of other stuff going on, and I didn't even recognize him, quite frankly, and his biggest challenge wasn't so much the physical things that were going on with him, but what had apparently been a part of this degenerative thought processes from banging your head together so many times. And look, back then, we didn't have the helmets like they have today. You see those things they're wearing now? I don't even know what those cost. I can't even imagine. But we didn't have that. We had water helmets, air helmets, and the ever-present suspension helmet that's supposed to keep the helmet off your head. So there is a price to be paid, and there's a benefit on the return on investment. And then there's that thing in the middle where if I'm doing something or I'll forget something that I was doing, I wonder if anybody else has that. Well, of course, part of it is getting old. I get that. And so I'm actually heartened when I'm on Facebook for a few minutes and somebody says, yeah, I forgot why I walked into the room. You ever had that happen? I'm like, yeah. But I know they didn't play semi-pro college football. or high school football, that's for sure. So I'm like, well, that makes me feel a little bit better. But there are times where I start to wonder, and it's hard not to. Now, there's no blame here for me. Let me just be clear on that. There's no class action lawsuit that I'm part of. If there was one, I don't even know if I'd, I mean, I can't prove it, you know, outside of just regular aging. I didn't take the kind of hits. However, let me just say this real quick. I didn't take the kind of hits that Mike Adamley would have taken at the pro level, but it's all relative, meaning you get hit by a guy that's 275 pounds running full speed, whether they're in the NFL or not, it's going to freaking hurt. So there's this one of all the games I played in and all the times that I was strapped on a football helmet, the most challenging, hardest, bell-ringing, I see stars hit came when I was playing semi-pro ball. I was probably 245, 250 pounds then. And they sent this kid who was a load and a half. He was about 260 pounds. His name was Robbie. And he was wearing double zero. And they put him at fullback in front of his brother to open a blocking, you know, blocking lane for him. And they ran the ball. And they were probably in a six-yard line. And Robbie and I met in the hole. And all I thought was, this is what it must have been like back in the day when the Titans rammed into each other. Because we're both full speed, face-to-face contact. And we hit each other so hard that we were literally holding each other up. And his brother scooted right around me and scored a touchdown. And I don't know how long we stood there. But at the time, it was hell of a hit, Augie. Hell of a hit. Hell of a hit. And I don't know what kind of damage that did in that moment. The human brain is not meant to be jostled around in the brain bucket, the skull, any more than the human knee is meant to be knocked out, you know, by a pulling guard on a trap play. So it could take years for these things to show up and manifest. And Matt Blair is a prime example. Brilliant human being, amazing photographer, great guy. And years later, all of a sudden, this became something for him. Now, he's not had an autopsy. There's no results on that yet. I don't know if he's even gone in that direction, his family, to say this needs to be looked into. But I know he was an outspoken advocate towards the end of his life about safer helmets and things like that for the players today. And then I have to juxtaposition all of that I just said with my friend Jerry Kramer, who played for Lombardi's Packers for a decade, was in the first two Super Bowls. I was at his Hall of Fame induction in 2018. He's one of the, if not the best, offensive guard in the history of the game. He's 84, and he's clearer than I am some days. So how do you explain that a Matt Blair plays 12 years in the NFL and passes at 70 from these difficulties connected at this point, it seems, to CTE, and you got Kramer, who played guard, which is banging heads every play, and he's 84 going on 85, and he's got some other physical problems, but there's no mental decline there. So that's the right down the middle for me. Those are all the factors that I've been thinking about the last few days, as quite frankly, jammed up my thought processes, because I can't quite get my grasp on it. And when I can't get a grasp on things, I tend to push everything off to the side until I do. Otherwise, it's just piecemeal. It doesn't work for me. So I think what the big takeaway is really comes down to the concept of disposable heroes, because that's what they are. And I don't think, I can't fix that. Meaning, you know, people walk around wearing jerseys of Walter Payton. Walter's been gone 20 years now, 21 years, wearing jerseys of people that are no longer with us. And there is some measure of respect there, but it's an assembly line, really. No different than when I played high school football. You know, you march through, you come as a freshman, and then a sophomore, junior, senior, and you graduate and go on, and then a whole new crop of kids come in. And then in college, it was the same way. I played 3 out of 4 years there, and then it was time to move on. And then semi-pro, I played six, seven years, way too long, some people would say. And I retired from football at the age of 30. That was 32 years ago. So while the injuries, the marks on me, the physical difficulties that I deal with now, I haven't played football in 3 decades plus, and they're still there. And they're not going away anytime soon. I'm always looking for the next salve, or, you know, if I can put my hands in warm water, I'm good. Ice is my best friend sometimes. But again, these are things that I knew going in, that this is what the ramifications were, but nobody knew going in, that I know of, especially at the high school level and the college level, that these god-awful collisions, let me put it this way, it's not a contact sport, it's a collision sport. And there's a difference. Contact is like touch you and off you go. Collision is 250-pound guys banging each other's brains out, you know, for 2 hours on a Saturday. And didn't know what could come out of those things. Nobody knew. I can remember being at practice when I was a junior. And it was the first time we had this drill. It was in a chute. And so there'd be, I'd be, you know, the defensive guys on one side and the offensive guys on the other side is the ball carrier behind the blocker. And they blow the whistle and you go and you meet in the chute and you have to make the tackle and shed the blocker and all that kind of stuff. And sometimes it worked and sometimes you didn't. And I got hit by a guy named Mark Contreras so hard, I think I was looking out my ear hole. And I had what was called a stinger, which is a pinched nerve, I think, in my neck. And I literally couldn't move on the ground. My head was turned to the side. I got this stinger. And after that, I started wearing a neck roll, which kind of helped. But that stinger took years to go away. It would happen again when I was playing semi-pro. And I get this, it was literally like somebody taking a hot poker or running hot lava down your spine. And not a lot of fun, but it was just part of the game. And you shake it off and you go on. So again, while it was important, I think, at least for me, to ignore those kind of hurts that were nagging, I don't have any spine problems now. I can walk and all that kind of stuff. But I do concern myself sometimes about this thought process stuff, especially when a guy like Matt Blair, who, when I put this post up on Facebook about Matt's death last week, I put a picture of him up as a photographer with his hat backwards, doing what he loved to do, which is taking pictures of nature. I didn't put a picture of him up as a linebacker for the Minnesota Vikings because he was so much more than a football player. And I think that's one of the things that gets lost in the game. You know, it's I love the game. I watch as often as I can. I'm not hung up whether or not there's flyovers or who kneels. I don't care about that stuff. That's majoring in minor things. I'm there to watch football. And that's a choice. And as a matter of fact, as we go to press right now, nobody's really going to press anymore. But as I'm getting ready to lock down this podcast, the Bears are playing the Rams tonight. And I'm going to be ordering a pizza and watching the football game. And that's what I enjoy doing because I played the game and I understand it and I appreciate what they're doing. Most fans, I don't think, take it that far. Sports talk radio is... anyway, that to me is just diminishes the whole effort of the game. There's nothing worse than people who know everything about everything but haven't actually done anything they're talking about. When I watch a lot of these guys get on talking about the game and what they need to do, and I'm like, did you ever play? Well, not really. Then shut it. All the color commentators that played the game, I'm tuned right in. You played it, you get it. We can disagree there or agree there, but the rest of it, no thanks. And the reason I bring this up is because the game itself, the actual game, not the breads and circuses around it, not who did what to, none of that stuff, none of the talk radio stuff, the actual game itself, from the time of the kickoff to the final whistle, there is a sacredness about it for me. I can't explain it. Unless, if you're listening to this and you played football at any level or coached it, you get it. You understand it. And I think that people who have not been a part of that physically, mentally, spiritually, and emotionally, giving your all when you're behind or when you're ahead, that has such tremendous takeaway value. And then add to it, especially the fact that none of us got paid to do it. We never got a dime. You know, I think there's something even more sacred about that. We did it because we knew we were investing in ourselves in the long run. I think about high school football. I was in high school 48 months, on and off. And out of those 48 months, the football season was only about 6 to 8 weeks long. And then if you add practice, that's about 3 or 4 more weeks. And, you know, maybe 12, 15 weeks the whole year. Spring football, you got captain's practice, you got summer sessions, and you got the actual season. You know, so out of the year, it's just weeks. It's not months. Maybe, what, 2 months out of the year total? 3, maybe? That's it. So the time playing ball in high school was really, compared to being in school, was very small. College was a little different. I preferred to play football and go to class. That caught up me eventually. But I figured it out, took care of that. So, I mean, really, when you look at it in those perspectives and with that idea of the game itself, from start to finish in the 60 minutes time frame, That's where it all matters. The rest of it to me is just extracurricular activity. I don't pay much attention to it at all. And I'm amazed at how much time needs to be filled with majoring in minor things about players and statistics. And oh my gosh, for the most part, I just turn the sound off when I watch anyway, and just, it's a lot easier on me. So this is really what I wanted to get off my chest. This podcast, this particular one, while it's about Matt, it's about much bigger things. It's about Joe and it's about Phil and it's about everybody else I've lost that have gone ahead of me, full well knowing my turn will come when it's time and not before. And yet, what do I do with that time in between? That's the key. That's always been the key. And it's just like a football game. I know it starts. I know when halftime is. I know it's going to end. And I think in football terms, I'm hopefully just in the late third quarter of my life, maybe another quarter and a half to go. I'd be really grateful for that. So I don't waste time because the game's going to end and the gun's going to sound and we got to leave the field. And what you do on the field, man, that's what it's all about. That will trigger the things that you do off the field or not. But that time on the field that we're all in the game, and at some point the timeouts get less and less, and you know, some penalties here and there, and you may argue with a few calls, but the bottom line is it comes down to your performance. Win or lose. So it's a great metaphor for life, you know, and loss happens to and with all of us. And I've always maintained that it's not what happens to you in life that matters. It's a factor, but it's not the deciding factor. The deciding factor is how you respond to it. That's all that matters. I think it's one of the reasons I enjoyed playing defense more than offense. Offense knows the play. At least they're supposed to. Defense, we don't know what the play is. So we have to respond and react accordingly. Reaction is, of course, quicker. Response comes a little bit after that. But that's been the thing for me. It's just like football. Life, I don't know a lot of the time what plays come in my way. But I can defend against it and respond to it and react to it. And that's where we all should be these days with all that's going on in the world. Doesn't matter what happened. It's just a factor. It's not the deciding factor. The deciding factor is how you respond to it. And I will tell you that the Matt Blairs of the world and the Joe Laurinaitises of the world and the Phil Larsons of the world and all those other people in my life that have gone ahead of me that were just huge influences on how to go about your business while you're here, they learned how to respond to it and they did it in fine form. And I hope that you will consider doing that as well. Until next time, be safe in your travels. Take care. Adios.